You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest is Carol A. Stabile, a professor at the University of Oregon and the author of several books on feminism, race, and culture. And her latest book is Broadcast 41, Women and the Anti-Communist Blacklist. Carol A. Stabile, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
There's been many studies and novels and films about blacklisting in the film industry, but why has blacklisting in broadcasting gotten less attention, do you think?
That's an important question, and one that I thought a lot about when I was working on the book. I think there are a couple of reasons. First of all, television from the very beginning and radio before it were collaborative media, and so they didn't have the kind of status that author or auteur-driven media had at that point in time. I think people paid a lot more attention to individual producers, directors, and writers in Hollywood in ways that they didn't in broadcasting. There's also the fact that the Hollywood 10, very deliberately made headlines when they were blacklisted. And I think that the attention of Hollywood 10 into what was happening in Hollywood really eclipsed what was happening on the East Coast in radio and television. And then I think that the other part of things is that this is not a story that television has ever told about itself, which is interesting because I always think of television as it can be a very sort of sequel-driven media, like film as well. But this is one story that they've never told beyond, narratives about Ed Murrow and the Army McCarthy hearings. I think it's a hard story for television to tell because it doesn't paint a very positive picture of the industry at the moment of its formation.
So now your book, The Broadcast 41, deals with blacklisting in the broadcast industry at a time when radio was fading and television was on the rise. So what effect did a blacklist have on the shaping of television content in the 1950s?
The effect that blacklisting had on the television industry was multiple. And in the first place, you have a new industry that's just developing new routines. It's attracting talent from across media industries. Because keep in mind, in 1946, between 1946 and 1955, there really is no thing as a television writer. Those categories are being invented. So one of the first impacts was on the routines that the new medium developed and how it thought about content. So the blacklist made a whole range of topics and ideas controversial, and controversial was kind of a code word for progressive content. But what it meant is that from the very beginning, television in the United States became extremely reluctant to take on particular kinds of topics because of their because they were tainted by the blacklist. So to talk about immigration was immediately to evoke the specter of communism. To talk about race in a progressive sense was to immediately attract the attention of anti-communists. So there were a whole range of topics that really became difficult to handle on television, partly because people learned how to self-censor so that you didn't get in trouble and so that you didn't, you didn't draw attention, you didn't evoke any kind of controversy. I think the other thing, and this is related to that, is that it affected genres of television programming. So, for example, the popularity of crime drama, I think, really begins in the blacklist era because it was the one form of programming that wasn't considered controversial, which does seem kind of ironic, right, that it's okay to have homicide.
You can have violence. But
in American homes. But you can't have any form of quote race mixing. So those are examples. I think it also drove out a whole generation of progressive folks who'd been working in and around television. And that, of course, impacted mentoring in the new industry. It impacted the pipeline for ideas and creativity. So I think that those are three really important ways that the Blacklist affected what would appear on television for decades to come.
Well, you know, the big fear of communism, what I think is interesting about that is that I don't think most people then or now have any idea what communism actually was.
Right.
But communism was anti-Christ, anti-religion.
Right.
And so is to what degree is the Blacklist also anti-Semitic?
Well, the Blacklist was absolutely anti-Semitic. I tend to think of it in terms of white supremacy, because it was very much opposed to civil rights. The anti-Semitism was more subtle, I think, in the years after World War II, because of the specter of what happened in Europe. But you see that anti-Semitism in FBI files, especially Lillian Hellman's FBI files. She was a progressive playwright and author, and a lot of the backlash against her had to do with her being Jewish. It was subtle, it was coded, but it was very much part of it. That's an interesting question because it's complicated, right? I mean, if you look at the studios in Hollywood in 1950, many of them are still headed by very powerful Jewish men.
Right, sure.
But they're also caught in this predicament where they had to be very careful about what they were doing because of the broader anti-Semitism of the 1930s and 1940s.
Right, because they didn't want the world to know that the film industry was controlled by Jews.
Well, yeah, they didn't want to evoke that specter. And I think there's some really interesting research that suggests that in the 1930s, for example, radio in particular was almost totally silent about what was happening to Jews in Europe. Some scholars suggest that that's because people like Sarnoff were really worried about anti-Semitic backlashes. It didn't concern Gertrude Berg, right?
I mean,
Gertrude Berg was very, didn't pay attention to that, which is interesting.
Well, there had always been Jewish characters. Every radio program.
Right.
And it was funny because, like, Jack Benny was Jewish, but he had a Jewish character, Mr. Ketzel or somebody like that. And Minerva Pius is one of the people you mentioned in your book. She turns out to be one of the Broadcast 41, and she was
right. She
was Mrs. Nussbaum on Allen's Alley.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other thing that's important to note is because the Blacklist was about civil rights and because of progressive Jewish people's involvement in civil rights, those two were often intertwined in very important ways because anti-communists knew that people like Eddie Cantor were really working to break the color line in broadcasting. And they didn't like that, right? They also knew that someone like Ray Lev was a classical pianist, who said, I know as a minority that it's my responsibility to, work for the rights of immigrants and for people of color. And so that connection between progressive Jewish people's activism in media industries and civil rights was also one of the reasons that the Jewish people were disproportionately targeted in the publication Red Channels.
Yeah, talk a little bit about Red Channels, if you would.
Yeah, sure. So this is interesting, and I really thought that the Broadcast 41 would be the end of my work in sort of FBI files. But after I finished the book, I got a lot of new files on something called the Commonville Radio and Television Investigation. And the Commonville investigations were FBI investigations. It was short for Communist Infiltration. And so there was a Communist Infiltration of Radio and Television investigation. There was a Commonville Motion Pictures. There were Commonvilles involving the Quakers and other peace activists and so on and so forth. They're kind of, they're really, sort of precursors to the counterintelligence programs of the late 1960s. So I've been getting all these new files that are really letting me do a better job of piecing together what happened around Red Channels. So Red Channels was a publication of a group called the American Business Consultants. And the American Business Consultants were, it was a group founded by three former FBI agents in 1947, and they also published a newsletter called Counterattack, Facts to Combat Communism. And Counterattack published the names of people who were suspected of being either communists or fellow travelers. The fellow travelers really, really encompassed everyone from kind of New Deal liberals to members of the Communist Party. And in 1950, the American Business Consultants publishes Red Channels in June, and it's a listing of 151 people working in or around broadcasting who were said to be part of a communist takeover of radio and television. And this list was used by anti-communist organizations to target people and to pressure network sponsors and advertisers to fire them. They were used to screen employees at networks. They helped. They were also used to encourage networks to develop their own lists of personnel who were considered to be members of the Communist Party. So this is really the foundation of the blacklist is Red Channels.
And Red Channels was not involved with motion pictures, just with broadcasting, or did it have movie?
Yeah. No, it was strictly broadcasting. It was a report on communist influence in radio and television.
People who were listed in Red Channels, the idea is that television and radio is unlike films, or as a sponsor-driven media.
Right.
And so, you know, that people wouldn't buy Colgate if Colgate sponsored Gertrude Berg.
Right.
But in fact, was there a lot of public outcry before Red Channels was published that
right.
People boycotting products or anything like that?
Yeah. Well, one thing I forgot to mention that's really important is Red Channels was, the American Business Consultants was founded by three former FBI agents. And they were FBI agents who all left the Bureau within a 12-month period. J. Edgar Hoover, who was director of the FBI, was very incensed because he believed that these three agents had stolen FBI files that they used to start their new business. And what they did with that business was they published Counterattack. And so they would go to businesses, let's say to networks and advertisers, and say, look, this person that you've hired, or this person that you have on television, is listed in this publication, which not coincidentally we've put together, as being a communist, and you need to know this. And you probably want to use our services to screen personnel or to clear people who we've identified as communists. And at first, the networks, what's interesting in reading the FBI files is that the networks were kind of resistant to this. These were people who were making them a lot of money. They were very successful. If you think about people like Philip Loeb, who was on the Goldbergs, or William Sweets, who was ironically producing Gangbusters, which was kind of based on G-Men activities. And so at first there's evidence in the FBI files where people will contact the FBI and say, listen, we've been contacted by this outfit called, the American Business Consultants. We don't want to give in to them because, honestly, we haven't heard from anyone else that there's a problem. but do you know who they are? And so I think that what networks were trying to do is to see if there was a connection with the FBI. Because if there was no connection with the FBI, they were going to tell these people to, you know, I think that one of the FBI says, you know, they can go to H-dash, right? They can go to hell. But if they were backed by the FBI, then the networks certainly weren't going to run the risk of angering J. Edgar Hoover in the Bureau. So in the beginning, there's a lot of back and forth and a lot of communication about whether these are actually representatives of the FBI, whether they're kind of rogue agents. And the FBI decides not to intervene. They basically say to the networks and to advertisers who contacted them, well, you know, they're former, we can confirm that they're former agents, but they're kind of on their own. So they neither confirm nor deny the relationship. And I think that the networks and the advertisers and sponsors began to be very concerned that they were going to cross the FBI and they were going to cross the Bureau. And so as a result of that, they really made a lot of concessions to what were only a very few telegrams and phone calls, and most of them organized by the American business consultants and the people they were partnering with.
So if Sarnoff and Paley had stood up to them, the blacklist would never have happened.
You know, I think that's really true. Robert Kintner at ABC did stand up in the case of Gypsy Rose Lee, and he won a Peabody for having done so. But he was really the exception. I think people just fell in line and made these concessions. Part of it is that, you know, the Korean War had just started. The anti-communists were really kind of whipping up fears about communism. And so, you know, someone said nothing acts as scared as $1 million, right? And I think that's what happened in the television industry.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. My guest is Carol A. Stabile. She is a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and associate dean for strategic initiatives for the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Oregon. And she's the author of Feminism and the Technological Fix, White Victims, Black Villains, Gender, Race, and Crime News in U.S. Culture, and her new book, The Broadcast 41, Women and the Anti-Communist Blacklist. Tell us a little bit about who the Broadcast 41 were. I don't know how to say it. Who are they?
Sure. The Broadcast 41 were the 41 women who were listed in Red Channels. And as I mentioned earlier, Red Channels included a list of 151 people working in and around broadcasting. And that meant that in an industry dominated by men, more than a third of those were blacklisted were women. And they were everyone from choreographers like Helen Tenieris, who had worked for the Works Progress Administration in the 1930s and who was known for incorporating African-American spirituals and African-American singers and dancers into her performances. It included people like, you mentioned Minerva Pyatt before, who had played a character known as Mrs. Nussbaum on television. It included playwrights like Lillian Hellman and writers like Darcy Parker and screenwriter and novelist Vera Caspary. So it cast a very, very wide net because these were people, some of whom had worked in broadcasting, some of the people I think they were worried would make the move into broadcasting. And so that's the group of women I call the Broadcast 41. I describe them as the Broadcast 41, first of all, to emphasize what a loss this was to the industry. This is a whole cohort of very powerful women who had managed to succeed in an industry in which it was really difficult to do that in the 1930s and 1940s, and who were extremely excited about the possibilities for television and progressive ideas in the post-war era.
Well, all histories of television our histories of the television that was rather than the television that wasn't. So if the blacklist hadn't happened and these women hadn't been blacklisted, how would you see the history of television that wasn't? What would have happened?
Well, and I need to include progressive men in this, too, because there were also men who were very much concerned about race and gender and related progressive issues. I think what might have happened is something that I found in archives, because you don't find it on the screen. What happened on screen and what got produced was really a result of the blacklist and structured by the blacklist. But you can see in archives the scripts that people had written, the screenplays that they hung on to for years and years in the hopes that they might someday be able to produce them. One of the scripts I write about is a script by Adrian Scott, who is a member of the Hollywood Ten. He wrote a script called Ellie or the Wayward Wife, which is about a housewife who goes on strike because she dislikes the working conditions. And that's an example of content that you wouldn't see again until the Roseanne Barr show in the 1980s. I think that what happened is that a lot of progressive content got delayed for decades in some cases. And I think here I've just been doing some additional research on Freddie Washington. Freddie Washington is probably best known for her role in the 1934 version of The Imitation of Life, the film The Imitation of Life, in which she plays Piola, a woman who passes as white. And
that's the Claudette Colbert version.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And she went to Hollywood and performed in Hollywood for a time, but found the roles available to her as an African American woman so restrictive that she left the industry altogether. But she talks a lot about how the influence she had as a performer on the scripts that got produced. Because people did have power as performers to say, you know, I can't speak these lines. These lines aren't authentic to the character. And so she talks a good bit about how in The Imitation of Life there was significant back and forth about some of the lines that she would speak. She also did that. She had a recurring role on Gertrude Bergs of Goldbergs, in which she played a maid. But she insisted that the dialogue and the character be altered so that it was a role that she felt wasn't stereotypical. And you could see it in the margins of the script, right? Freddie Washington's corrections to the script. So I think she's an example of performers who would have affected the content of what we saw. But she was also a writer and a journalist. And so for 4 years, she wrote an entertainment column for a Harlem newspaper called The People's Voice that was published by Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. And in that, she criticized television and film for the representations of black Americans. She lobbied for better roles and better working conditions for black performers. So, you know, all of this criticism is you know, it's important to remember the ways in which that was suppressed, too, because I think criticism also helps writers and creators think more critically about what they're doing. And when that pipeline got shut off, I think it meant that people who are really interested in, say, Roots, Roots doesn't appear until, 1979. But all of these people were talking about programs like Roots and about content like Roots. You know, decades beforehand. But the blacklist made it really impossible to have those conversations about race without being targeted and identified as a communist. So those are a couple of examples of how content might have been different. I think certainly there were feminist ideas that were in the mix in the late 1940s and 1950s based on the experiences these women had had in industries that were often hostile to their presence. And so by making it impossible for people who are writing that kind of content to find jobs in the industry, it meant that that never had a chance to appear.
So instead we got Barbara Billingsley.
Yeah, and, you know, I want to say people did what they could in the structures, and I think that there are examples of people really trying to do progressive work. I think about the Waltons, ironically, which became a refuge for a lot of blacklisted talent, right? That was one place where I think, you know, people who'd been blacklisted, like Will Gare, started to find work again, and people, writers who'd been blacklisted, also found work on shows like that.
A lot of writers had fled to England and wrote things like Robin Hood over there.
Yeah. The costume drama craze was in part initiated by people like Hannah Weinstein, who had left the United States and were producing in England. So I think the takeaway here is that television was really deprived of diversity and creativity in the United States in ways that would impact the industry until cable started challenging some of the constraints of the network system in the late 1980s and 1990s.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You are listening to From the Bookshelf here on KSCO. And my guest this week is Carol A. Stabile. She's the author of The Broadcast of 41, Women and the Anti-Communist Blacklist. One of the members of the Broadcast 41, women who were blacklisted from broadcasting during the communist scare of the 1940s and 50s, was Minerva Pius. She was a Jewish radio comedian who appeared regularly on the Fred Allen radio program as Mrs. Nussbaum. And I thought you might enjoy hearing a little bit of Minerva Pius at work. Here she is as Marie Antoinette.
Marie Antoinette, your time has come. Soldiers, take the prisoner to the guillotine.
Or this walk alone will kill me.
Marie Antoinette, before we are chopping off your head, do you got any last words?
Last words, Yvonne? What is there to say? If you were standing here, would you have any last words? It's going to make a difference, last words. I told you what I was thinking I could be arrested. Last words, Yvonne. Maybe you could think of something to say? If you were here in my place with a big hatchet waiting to chop off your head, then you'd see it wouldn't be so easy to quick ad-lib something. Why, believe me, how I suffered in that dirty, rotten Bastille. Me, a queen, with my background. As sure as my name is Marie Antoinette, someday you're gonna be sorry you were mixed up in a thing like this. Like I was saying to Louis just the other day. I said, Louis, I said, those riffraff I have in you too good. The trouble with me and you, Louis, I said, is that we're too easygoing. Pushovers for a sad story. And how did the whole trouble start? I'll tell you how it started. All my life, I said, have a peace fruit. Eat a little something. Look how you look. And one day, I said, let him eat cake and look what they look.
That was radio and television comedian Minerva Pius. She was blacklisted for suspected communist affiliation during the 1940s and 50s, and she is one of the subjects discussed in a new book called The Broadcast 41 by my guest, Carol A. Stabile. And we're going to continue our conversation with Carol A. Stabile right after this break. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and my guest this week is Carol A. Stabile, and she is the author of the book The Broadcast 41, Women and the Anti-Communist Blacklist. Carol A. Stabile is also a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and associate dean for strategic initiatives for College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Oregon. She's the author of several books, including Broadcast 41, Carols to Bill. I want to talk about another subject that your book deals with, and that's the application of today's enlightened views on race and gender on artworks from the past. And you, for instance, you mentioned Gone with the Wind in your book and describe it as a racist film. So why is Gone with the Wind a racist film?
Well, Gone with the Wind celebrated the myth of the lost cause. And it really was part, I really think of it as being part of the monumentalization of a view of the South that was grounded in white supremacy. And what was interesting to me in doing the research for the book is what a flashpoint Gone with the Wind was in media industries. There was a lot of discussion and debate about the racism of Gone with the Wind in 1938 and 1939. And in fact, that became a kind of mark of a communist that someone would dare to criticize Gone with the Wind during that era. So I don't think it's not like we're taking. I think this is a super interesting question because it's not like we're taking these ideas from the present and mapping them onto the past. What I'm suggesting, and one of the things that I think is really exciting about some of the research being done now, it's those ideas were really in the air in the years before the end of World War II and up until the 1950s. And people really believed that television as a new medium could be used to promote inclusion and tolerance and be part of educating and uplifting people rather than speaking to fears and divisions.
Okay, but a movie like, say, Birth of a Nation, that film is clearly racist in that the black characters are played by white people in blackface, and the heroes of the film are the Ku Klux Klan who rescue the helpless whites from the evil Negroes. Whereas Gone with the Wind depicts a family, you know, the O'Haras or whatever. And it's they're the central characters, and what happens to them did happen to people like that, and they did own slaves, and the slaves are not shown in any real demeaning way. I mean, Hattie McDaniel is one of the great characters in the story.
I actually think that that there's substantial debate about that. Hattie McDaniel's character in particular is one of, is one of the most powerful and abiding stereotypes of black women. Don Bogle wrote a book called Black Hollywood that talks at some length about that. But the mammy figure, who is there to tend the white family, who is basically okay with her subservient position in society. That's a stereotype that a lot of people at the time were criticizing and saying, when black Americans can only appear in Hollywood films as one of these very stereotypical characters, whether it's the Jezebel, whether it's the mammy, whether it's a Zip Coon character, then that's a problem. And in Gone with the Wind, again, has this kind of paternalistic and benevolent view of the slave system that I think many progressives in the 1930s were actively challenging.
Okay, but if you take a character like Hattie McDaniel, or say Louise Beavers, who is, you know, in any film that you've ever seen that has a black woman, it's either Louise Beavers or Hattie McDaniel. So Louise Beavers in, say, Holiday Inn, her character, her mammy character, is stereotypical. Because, you know, I mean, she's definitely happy with her subservient place in society and makes fun of herself and her children. Whereas Hattie McDaniel, even though it has become a stereotype, isn't her character rooted in reality? Couldn't there have been a character like Mammy?
Well, I think when the point is about when the only representation you saw in film were these particular representations that really conform to a narrow formula about black women, then that's at the heart of the problem. Freddie Washington, actually, because Hattie McDaniels went on to appear in Song of the South.
Right.
And there was the black press in particular was very critical of black performers who took on these roles. And Freddie Washington makes, I think, an excellent point about visibility. And that's that, well, what are you going to do if you're a black actor and these are the only roles that are available?
Right, not work.
Right. You know, and it takes a certain amount of privilege to say, right, you can walk away from these roles. I think what Freddie Washington was really critical of is when black performers made apologies for the roles and apologies for the stereotypes. And I do agree that, the roles that were available to black performers in Gone with the Wind were really narrow.
All right.
And very stereotypical. Yeah.
Yes, I agree. But yeah. Let me ask you this. So,
sure.
Kate Smith.
Right.
Kate Smith was a singer in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. She died in the 1980s. And she was a terrific person, a very nice woman. I met her once. And she most famously sang God Bless America. Her theme song was The Moon Comes Over the Mountain. Early in her career, she was kind of a bluesy mama kind of character singer. And then God Bless America kind of became the thing that she's most well remembered for. And after 9/11, the Yankees began playing God Bless America every seventh inning stretch, and the Philadelphia Flyers had identified with Kate Smith, and they had a statue of her in front of their arena since 1987. But now the Yankees and the Flyers announced that they'll stop playing Kate Smith's record of God Bless America, and they are going to put a tarp over her statue, because among the numerous recordings she made in her long career were a song called Pickaninny Heaven and another called That's Why Darkies Were Born. And at the time that she recorded those songs, which are demeaning to black people, those songs were recorded by, that's what people, Bing Crosby, who, you know, embraced African-Americans, certainly, and Eddie Cantor, you mentioned, those people, everybody recorded those songs.
This is such an interesting conversation to me, because I think that you just hit the nail on the head. Not everybody did. And I think for me, it's really important to think about the people who didn't and the people who refused. And again, it would be one thing if you had a whole range of representations. So let's say you did have, African-American women represented as domestic workers. But you also had African-American women represented as, like, Harriet Tubman, right, leading people north. But when the only representations you have conform to this very, very narrow formula, then that's where we're working in the realm of really harmful stereotypes, I think. Does that make sense to you?
It does, but at the same time, I think, well, Kate Smith would be devastated to know that her songs had ever caused anybody any pain.
Well, you know, I don't know. I haven't done research on Kate Smith, but the research that I've done on Hazel Scott and Lena Horne and Freddie Washington, what that showed me is that they were women, Lena Horne and Hazel Scott in particular, wrote language into their contract that let them have control over how they were represented and what they would wear, because they were really, really concerned about how the industry would represent them in stereotypical ways. So Hazel Scott refused to perform as anyone but herself because she didn't want to play a Jezebel. She didn't want to play a character that she didn't feel was real and was respectful. And so I think where they could, people like that exercise control. Unfortunately, it meant for most of them that they wound up leaving Hollywood altogether. So Hazel Scott gets in, she has this this clause in her contract that says she'll only wear her own wardrobe because she wanted to make sure that she had control over the clothing that she appeared in. And she got into a fight with Harry Cohn of Columbia because of a representation of black women wearing what were called Hoover aprons.
Right.
And they were dirty. And Hazel Scott said, I don't want to do this. You know, I don't want to appear with a group of African-American women wearing Hoover aprons. And he finally had to give in because of the contract, but she didn't work again in Hollywood because of that. So I think, for me, like, understanding what they tried to do and the ways in which they tried to resist those stereotypes is really important. And I haven't done enough research on Kate Smith to understand the constraints that she had to function in and how she tried to resist them.
But I guess the question I'm asking that you talk about in your book is, you know, you, and rightfully so, you talked about President Trump's chief of staff saying, well, we can't apply today's ideas to things that happened 500
right.
years ago,
right. Right.
Which is ridiculous. But but at the same time, look, let's look at, say, the Marx Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were great and funny, and their movies are wonderful, and they, in right. fact, were progressive. You know, I think they were, mm-hmm. you know. But if you look at their films, like, say, A Day at the Races, there's a scene where Harpo goes
right.
down and sings with Ivy Anderson and all the sort of, you know, very demeaning scene, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put on blackface in the film. And there's many, right. many, many, many sexist, Harpo is a leering, and Groucho,
oh, yeah.
of course. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So if you apply, you know, you know what I'm saying? You deprive people of the enjoyment of a certain art form that happened before now because it is less enlightened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I tend to... These are really important and difficult questions and conversations, but I think for me it's important to know that there were people who didn't do those things. There were people who knew, even then, that these weren't good representations, that they weren't equitable and that they weren't fair. And so I think my hope is to amplify attention to those moments, to show that resistance in the past, because I think it's really important. I think it's important to know that there were people of courage and conviction who didn't, like, think about Garson Kanin, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Judy Holliday is in Born Yesterday, and, you know, it's Born Yesterday's Pygmalion, but I think that really interesting things happen in Born Yesterday because Garson Kanin brings a different sensibility to it, you know? I mean, obviously he had done Adam's Rib before that, which is a really interesting and very progressive take on heterosexual relationships and gender roles. So I think that paying attention to those moments where people were trying to push back and challenge some of those stereotypes and some of those behaviors, I think it gives you a different sense of the past and of the present.
Well, Born Yesterday is one of the great... It's one of the greatest films ever made. And
she's amazing,
she's
too.
So great in it. Yeah, her awakening,
right?
Her awakening through literature.
Yeah. It's a brilliant film. She's a brilliant actress. But again, I think that thinking about those moments where people had the conviction and courage, to do some of the things that Milton Berle and Eddie Cantor did around race on television. I mean, they paid a price for it, but they knew that was the right thing.
Well, it's a fascinating book. Carol A. Stabile is
Thank
the author.
You.
It's called The Broadcast 41. Women and the Anti-Communist Blacklist. And I recommend it to all of you listeners. Carol A. Stabile, thank you so much for spending some time
being quizzed by me. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.